Welcome to the Travelling Senorita, episode number 40, in ISO, but still dedicated to doing this storytelling using the platform of podcasting because it makes my heart sing. And I find wonderful friends, new friends, old friends, and they're all creatives across the globe, whether it's in food, art, anything to do with culture. And today I have found Chef, because I always believe that chefs are true artists, artisans of the food. And this chef is from Scotland, but now lives in northern New South Wales and works in a wonderful restaurant called Pottinger, which is a kitchen garden restaurant up in the top of Carool on a mountain. Very gorgeous. But today we're going to find out how a chef becomes a chef who starts off as a welder. His name is Mikey Lee and he's from Scotland. Hello, Mikey.
Hi, Kaylee.
I've got a theme of Scottish dudes lately.
That's it.
Yeah, and we were just talking about Andy Scott,
yeah.
Who was on the show a couple of weeks ago. And you know him. Well,
you know his work. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So you're a welder.
Yes.
Before you became a chef.
Yeah.
But before we get there, tell us about growing up in... Where were you born?
I was born in Edinburgh in Scotland.
Yep.
Right near the castle, the famous castle there. There was
really?
A little hospital at
the
bottom of the street I was born in. I think it's an old person's home now, but it used to be a maternity hospital. So I was born pretty close to the heart
How
of the city.
Beautiful. That's amazing, that spot.
Yeah, the famous, where they have the fringe, the cobbled streets and stuff.
Isn't just it called there. Arthur's Seat up the top there?
Yeah, close, like where I sort of grew up, there was a housing commission estate on the edge of the city. So about train spotting,
Really? Talk to me about your upbringing.
It was a rough area, a lot of crime, a lot of drugs, a lot of social issues, but also like a lot of community as well. I still have a lot of family there, aunties, my nana still lives there.
Yeah.
Most of my cousins and aunties have moved from there now, but not too far away, some still there.
Is it still a commission area?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well,
they're very, very nice of the city to give that land over, really. Good on them for supporting families all throughout that time and not kicking them out to tourism.
Because
Edinburgh is like a massive tourist destination.
Yeah, massive.
So growing up, was it like that or not?
Oh, growing up there, it was good. And a lot of mischief. And you saw a lot of things that probably, when you look back, you think, oh, that was a bit sketchy or a bit dangerous. But I suppose every city's like that.
Yeah, but were you in the heart of that? Do you feel like that you're in the gritty side of Edinburgh?
Nah, and I moved away. I moved from the city when I was six to a little rural village, an old shale mining village in West Lothian. It's about 25 minutes outside the city.
So the family wanted to sort of get a bit more sort of farm nature?
Yeah. We were living in a high rise in the middle of, and not a very desirable era to bring up kids,
next
I guess.
Next to the castle, though.
You could see Arthur's Seat in the castle from the high rise.
Right, and it's still like that now, hey?
Yeah, it's still there, yeah.
Yeah, that's a part of the city as a tourist you don't kind of see.
So
tell me about, because when you're not very far out of Glasgow or Edinburgh when we were driving, you just come across the most greenest pastures and just real beautiful parts of Scotland. We went up to the Highlands as well, but, you know, literally just out of the city. So were you talking...
Half an hour outside. So it was a lot of fields around, a lot of farmers. It was just used to be a shale mining village. It's called Winchborough in West Lothian.
Yeah, right.
Near Linlithgow, if you've heard of it.
Yeah.
Mary Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
That's where I went to school in Linlithgow.
And so what were your parents doing for a crust? What were they doing?
My mum was looking after us.
Yeah.
So my mum had two boys, me and my younger brother, to her first marriage.
Yeah.
My dad was an electrician. And then they separated when I was about six.
Yep.
And then my mum remarried and had twin girls with my stepdad.
Oh, hello. Yeah. This is where the twins come in, of course.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. And so happy family?
Yeah, it was good. My stepdad was, he took on me and my brother when he was, I think my mum was 28. He was 19.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they're still together now?
No, not anymore. No, they separated probably about 6-7 years ago, and then my mum passed away a couple of years after that.
Oh, bless. So she passed away quite young.
Yeah, 57.
Really?
I think.
And you've still you've got twin sisters?
Yeah.
Yeah. And how old are they now then?
They're 20.
They're young.
How old was I? 14? They're about 24, 25.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And are they all still over in Scotland?
Yeah.
So you're the only one that's over in Australia?
Yeah, I moved here alone.
Right. And so growing up in a semi-rural area, what did you want to do something with your hands? What did you end up choosing to do before you fell into chefing?
Oh, well, I was good at school, but I didn't like the study part. I didn't like...
The rules.
The rules. And there was a few kids that used to bash me. So I started to hate school. Mm. I was always good academically. I never had to study
Mikey, I would have bashed them back.
I had a couple of scuffles, but no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Got to stand
I'm
up
a lover and not a
hate. You've got to stand up to bullies, though, you know. They deflate pretty easy when you do.
So by the time I got to 14, I wanted out of school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I told my parents that. And, you know, my mum's response was, if you're leaving school, you have to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'm still a bit like that now. I always feel like there's something I want to do, but I don't know what it is yet. Like.
Oh, I think it's chefing for sure. But we've jumped a few years there. So tell me what you ended up doing.
So, yeah, I left school when I was 15.
Yep.
Went to college and sort of like an entry-level engineering course that introduces you to electrical engineering, mechanical, the fabricating, a good gas refrigeration. So a good scope, different engineering, you know, what's the word? Disciplines, different disciplines. And then you can sort of see what you like or what you're interested in from that.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed the fabricating and the welding side of it and making stuff with my hands. My
mum
was creative.
That's why you've admired Andy Scott's work.
Andy, yeah.
So mum was creative. What was mum doing?
Oh, she loved to paint, knit, draw, craft.
She's always one.
Yeah. Before she passed away, she was painting me an emu egg to post over. I brought that back with me.
Oh,
so,
did you? Bless.
Yeah, she did a sort of Aboriginal
style.
She was always doing something like...
It's striking me that you were really close to your mum.
Huh? Oh, yeah, very, yeah.
Yeah, bless.
Very close.
So how long ago did she pass away?
About 5 years ago now.
Yeah, right.
That was the last time I was back in Scotland.
Yeah. Must be hard for you, that one, going back home when she's not there. It's And so I love Scotland. I love Glasgow because Andy Scott, you know, he goes, Edinburgh is Edinburgh, but you've got to see Glasgow. And he showed us the sort of the gritty, the culture and the underground Glasgow. But it's a really hardcore place to go.
Oh, it's
up.
Weather
drives most of that. You know, you must laugh over here when people say it's cold at the moment because this ain't nothing, right?
Yeah.
And it's just cold, which kind of creates this real, you know, it's got a working class vibe to it. It's known for tourism as well, but it's a really hardcore place, Scotland, isn't it? It's a beautiful place, but it's not for the faint-hearted. You've got to be pretty hearty.
There's a lot of social issues. I don't know if it's weather. It's culture and weather, I guess. It's so cold.
But they're hearty people. I love the Scottish. I find them really resilient and hearty.
Yeah.
So is that how you feel as a Scotsman?
Oh, sometimes. I'm proud to be Scottish, 100%. Yeah. I can feel...
Yeah.
Sometimes the Scotsman comes out in me occasionally.
I can see it a mile away, which I really like.
But yeah, we are resilient. We're fighters. We're always the underdog kind of nation. We have to fight and scrape and battle for everything, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of... They're the words I was looking for, actually. Because I lived in London, but I'd visit Scotland a lot. And I actually felt warmer going to Scotland than when I did in the hierarchy of the English...
Yeah.
You know, the class and caste structure. I felt like Scottish was, even though it was hard living, it was a softer, more open heart.
Yeah. They're very welcoming, but loving.
Yeah. Funny, like the Irish. Yeah.
People were passionate.
Yeah. So you ended up doing that course, and then what did you end up doing? Did you end up becoming a welder?
So yeah, I enrolled full time to do the 12-month course, and I went into the fabrication side of that, and from that, went into an apprenticeship in a place called South Queens Ferry, where the Forth Road bridges are.
Yep.
Like I don't know if you know them. There's a road bridge and a rail bridge. The beautiful architecture. I think the rail bridge was the biggest type of its design in the world at the time. It's a symbolic bridge. It's amazing. So I did my apprenticeship pretty much underneath those bridges in a little marina there.
Right, okay.
So there's a lot of people with the boats.
Great place to work.
Yeah, it was like right on the water, like freezing, so cold. Yeah.
That's what Andy often says because he's got to get on the tools, you know, and he's like, this isn't for the faint heart.
Yeah, I've been, you know, on sites welding in the snow. Dangerous.
In snow. Yeah, welding in the snow.
Looking back, like, you know, like lucky you didn't die.
None of the sparks are going to light a fire.
Yeah.
So you did an apprenticeship, and what did you find that was it the hands-on creative side that you really enjoyed about welding? Like, were you making staircases or what were you doing?
Yeah, we did a big variety of stuff. A lot of specially commissioned stuff from bars and restaurants. You know, we'd make bar tops or dining tables or old wrought iron steelwork, staircases, anything and everything.
Yeah.
A big variety of stuff. A lot of it architectural and know, copper and brass, aluminium. Pewter was a good one, that's soft like aluminium, very expensive. It ages up and polishes, like, really nice.
So that's a real art to that, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. Because each metal's got different techniques to... Yeah. And the client, how they want the thing to look. Sometimes we'd have to mirror polish or brush polish. And the welding techniques are all different. And, yeah, there's a lot to...
So
it's very involved.
So how many years were you welding for?
Oh, 12 years, I think. 11 or 12 years.
Right, and then did you just put down the tools and say, I'm going to go to Australia? How do we... Because it's a really interesting story. You're a head chef of... You are a head chef of an amazing restaurant now, but we met you at Seasons, which is one of, you know, a hatted restaurant, an award-winning restaurant. Then you went to Taverna, which is also a really renowned restaurant. And now you're at Pottinger. They're the three that I know of only, and they're all high-level restaurants in the sense of what they produce. And you are an executive chef at them. So it's not like you've just gone and tripped into that. But when you hear that you're a welder beforehand in... in the bridge areas, under the bridge in Scotland. It's like, how do you cross over and how do you end up in Australia and become a chef? That's really the story that we want to talk about today.
I don't know. I think when I came out to Australia the first time, when I was 23 doing my work and holiday visa, I was still welding at the time. And it was a friend of mine who'd been here before. I played soccer. I met him through the soccer team where I used to work at the bridges there. And him and his wife had been here before. And I was living with my high school sweetheart at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, needing a change, I saw the fella and my friend like, oh, 2 or 3 times a week. And he was like, we're going to go to Australia. Do you want to come?
Yeah.
And I was like, I hadn't even thought about it at first. And then I went home and I said to my girlfriend, you know, like, do you want to go to Australia? And she was like, oh, that'd be good. I was like, let's do it.
So she just, went too?
Yeah.
She came as well?
Yeah.
Wow. So, lovely. It's a lovely story.
Yeah, we just went home. Decided there and then, yeah, let's go to Australia. And a few months, I just went to my boss and said, you know, I'm going to quit because I'm going travelling. I just decided.
It's so funny, when you're on the other side of the world, it's like, I'm going to Australia.
I just decided, I was like, why not? Let's do it. Yeah.
And did you finish your apprenticeship at that stage?
Oh, yeah, I'd been qualified. Yeah. I was a foreman in the I'd qualified and made my way up to the...
Because you're a hard worker. That's who you are, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you come to Australia, you land in Sydney.
Yeah.
Right, and you start working in Sydney and living with your friends and having a blast. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, we sort of travelled. My friends had been... When they'd been here before, they'd spent most of the time here on the coast and they'd made a lot of friends here. So we started in Sydney and we travelled up on the Greyhound bus.
Yeah.
Stopping at all the famous places on the way and the backpackers. Yeah.
It's funny you should say that, because that's where we're rewinding to now. We're going to be rewinding to these road trips that all of us have forgotten to do after the COVID scenario. We're all going to be checking out the roads at home, which you guys love doing. Yeah. So where was one of your... most memorable places when you were up, going up and down the coast in the Greyhound buses?
Oh, the first place that springs to mind would probably... I can't remember if it was Coffs Harbour or Port Macquarie. And we pulled in at this little backpackers to stay there. And the guys checked us in and we looked... It was quite a cool place. It was like an old house. I can't even remember the guy's name, but it was right on this roundabout. And we were there 20 minutes and we saw a little car accident at the roundabout. And then even at nighttime, all you would hear was screech, bang. So we used to sit on the balcony... drinking beers as you do at the backpass and just watching people crash at this, this roundabout. Yeah.
And then there would have been a big banana up the road too.
Or probably.
That's all very funny for foreigners.
And the fella, I remember him, he left us there for 2 days and left me and my friend the keys to the hostel.
Look after it.
Yeah. And he just left. And left the keys to his office. He had money there, his computer. And he was like, I'm away for a few days. Here's the keys. If anybody checks in, do this. And he gave us a few nights. Free. Yeah, that was wicked. That was cool.
I love that. That's what you get when you're...
I always remember.
Yeah. And so where did you work in Sydney? Went back to Sydney and what did you do there?
I didn't do any... I didn't work for my...
Oh, this is the first trip. Then you went home.
6 months, yeah.
Right, gotcha. Okay, so you've gone back to Scotland to get back into the work, taking the childhood sweetheart home with you. You've got Australia out of your system. Mm. You start working again and then it comes up again. How does Australia come back up again?
Oh, so when I came out here with my girlfriend, we'd been together for 8 years. And the plan was to stay here for the whole year. We split up after about 7 weeks.
Oh, when you
after
see,
eight
right,
years, yeah.
Okay.
So she went back to Scotland.
Right.
So I was here, young single man in Australia.
Mm. Look out.
Yeah.
Australians love
travelled, partied until I needed money. And then it was like, oh, but I didn't want to weld. So I started doing jobs, whatever, in kitchens, washing dishes.
Mm-hmm.
I was helping my housemate at a fencing business, but I didn't like that because it was digging holes in the sun.
When you're washing the dishes at restaurants, is this when you start to...
Yeah.
Because the dishy always gets a really good insight into chefs, don't they? And I love, like, you know this about me, I love being out in the kitchen. It's like one of my favourite places in a restaurant. You'll very rarely find me sitting at a comfortably at a dining table. Yeah. I'll tend to try and go out into
like
the bar.
To be in the action.
Yeah, exactly. But there's this real rawness and organic... it's the heart of a restaurant is the kitchen, but it's also super creative. So were you watching that as a dishy and thinking, I can do this. This is cool. It must have got into your blood then.
Yeah, that's right. So I was washing dishes in this little Spanish restaurant where I met my wife. She was in the bar.
Yeah.
And I'd been offered the job through a mutual friend who knew a chef who needed someone to wash dishes. I'll put my hand up. So I was working in this kitchen and I liked the pace, the energy that... It was hard work, but I was used to hard work, so it was... I didn't find it that hard at first.
Yeah, coming from, like, below zero temperatures, welding.
There'd be mountains of dishes and pots, and I'd be... A lot of people would be overwhelmed. I'd be like...
I can do this.
Yeah, and then I'd finish, you know, all the dishwashing jobs pretty quick, and I'd get bored fast as I do. I'm like a little kid, and all this...
You know. And they wanted you to help with the...
Yeah, so that's for prep jobs today.
Yeah, right. That's how... Actually, a lot of chefs start as... a lot of restaurant owners, anyone, they all start as dishes.
Yeah.
Because it's the place where you really get to have insight into the whole without the stress of being a chef or a restaurant manager. You get to kind of just watch out from a kickback sort of perspective. But obviously learning the skills of prepping, so that you obviously had a chef that was happy for you to do it.
Yeah.
So along the way, you're learning skills, right?
Yeah.
And then you think, I'm going to go and do an apprenticeship or what happened?
I'd never cooked before. My girlfriend used to enjoy cooking and she never let me ever because she... Love to do it. So, you know, I'd just come home from work after welding and she would be making dinner. And so when I came and then when we separated, I had to start fending for myself.
Yeah.
And the Aussie way of life, having barbecues outside, I wasn't used to that from Scotland. So my friends, my housemates used to cook a lot, which that was a big inspiration for me. They would make roast lamb or mussels or baby ochi on the barbecue. And I didn't know how to do it, but I loved it. So I started asking them, how do you do that? Like, how are you making this?
And so what age are you when you're starting to inquire about?
23.
Right, okay. Yeah. So from that, did a restaurant take you on board as an apprentice? How did it go?
I finished my year here and I went back to Scotland.
Yeah.
But my girlfriend and I had been living together, but obviously we separated, so I moved back in with my parents. I'd left home when I was 16 or 17, so to go back at 23, 24.
As you do when you do all your dosh on an overseas trip. Yeah. I did the same thing in reverse, yep.
But I'd made my mind up I wanted to come back to Australia, so my parents had said, well, move back in with us, go back to your job, save your money, don't go out partying and blowing it all.
Yeah.
As you do at that age.
Good advice, Mum. Mm. Yeah.
So I started the application for my visa.
Yeah.
Myself, I didn't use a migration agent or nothing. I just...
And you were coming back as a welder?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was on the skills shortage list. So
fantastic, yeah.
You know, you need, I think at the time, 120 points
for
your visa. You got 30 for being under 30 years old, 30 for speaking English, even though I struggle with English because I'm Scottish, and 60.
For being a welder.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you made it back to Australia.
Yes.
And where did you live?
When I first moved back... I got a camper van.
Had you met your wife, though, and gone and come back?
Yeah, we dated for a few months, separated, went our separate ways, and then I was with a Fiji Indian girl for a couple of years. She actually came back to Scotland with me when I moved back to my parents. She came over a couple of months later.
Right.
And then we separated as well. It's like neighbours.
So, but Angelique's back here.
Yeah, and Angelique had left Australia a similar time to me and went to live in Europe I don't know. She was overseas for 5 years.
Did you catch up with her in Scotland?
Yeah, eventually we did, yeah.
Right, okay. So this is how it all kind of comes back together.
Yeah.
Right, and then you get your application approved to come back to Australia.
Yeah, I got my application. It took 2 years.
You land back in Sydney?
Yeah, I think, I flew a bit. Sydney or Melbourne? No, Sydney. We flew Sydney.
Sydney, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, did you live in Melbourne for a while?
No, we got me and my girlfriend came over, and got a camper van. So I hadn't seen the Great Ocean Road and stuff, so we got hired a camper van in Sydney.
Yeah.
Drove down Melbourne, saw the Great Ocean Road. Then we came inland and then met friends in Byron that I knew from back home that I grew up with. They were in Byron Bay, so we went there for maybe about a week.
You realise that this is where it's at up here?
Yeah. And then I wanted to go north, but I think it was wet season. So I couldn't go north. And then I was like, oh, well, back to the Gold Coast there is then. And I've just stayed here.
And so where do you do your apprenticeship for chefing? So you don the tools for welding. You've had that dishy experience. You've started to do a little bit of prepping. It's obviously in your blood. So who takes you on as a chef?
Well, I quit my job. I came back. I was still welding again. I started welding for a little family business in Burleigh.
Mm-hmm.
I was there maybe a year. And I just had one of those days, you know, where I was like, you know what? Yeah, I don't want to do it.
Were you thinking about food at this stage still?
Yeah, always. Like, I'd started cooking more, a lot more. I mean, even when I went back to Scotland after my year here, I was making... My mum hated cooking.
Yeah.
Hated it. And so I started making stuff, and she'd be like, what are you doing? I was like,
See the love playing. Of food, though? Yeah. I mean, you've gone from not at all as a young man to starting to really appreciate what food's all about.
Yeah, and I started getting bored at home because I didn't want to go out and... wasting money like partying. I was want to save to move here, so I would cook at home bored. I wouldn't tell my friends at the time. I'd make a chocolate cake and...
You are known for your dessert. I love it
because I was bored of something to do, and I started enjoying it. It gave me something
to study. A hardcore Scottish welder can't tell his friends that he's making a chocolate cake on a Saturday night.
Yeah.
That's changed, Mikey.
They'd say, what are you doing? And I'd be like, anything apart from I'm baking a cake.
So where do you do your apprenticeship?
I did it at the casino, the Star Casino.
Okay, all right. So they took you on.
Yeah.
They went, right, here's the Scottish welder who bakes cakes on a Saturday night. We're going to give this guy a crack.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a big place to learn.
Oh, yeah,
and you must have learned all facets from events right through.
From the very bottom in the veggie shop. Yeah. I think my first job was... Here's like 60 kilos of onions, chop them.
And so something I really admire about you too, when I first met you over at Season, you love, you were telling me that you would go down the beach and, you know, fossick for all sorts of different weeds and things, that you know, edible stuff.
Yeah, yeah, sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, so you love local produce wherever you live, you find it.
Yeah.
Do you think somewhere like the casino doesn't strike me as local produce per se, but what did they teach you there? Because I know the restaurants you've chosen since then have definitely had that threaded through them. What did you learn from the casino, other than you got the apprenticeship?
Oh, the casino was a massive part of, you know, how I still chef today in terms of, like, the discipline of it. And I found that a lot of it was very, very disciplined, very regimented and very methodical. And there was reason behind the way everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
Which I enjoyed that part of it because my old job was very disciplined and similar thing. I had to make maybe 2,000 metal brackets instead of in the casino. You maybe have 2,000 cakes to make.
Yeah, right.
So you got to do a certain procedure and you know kind of work like a bit not robotic but systematic and left to right. And there's a reason for that because it's speed, it's efficiency, it's consistency.
Do you know, you're touching on something here. We were talking about the mental health of chefs before. So these young sort of, not just young, but people that drop into chefing because they see it on MasterChef or television and think it's famous and, you know, glamorous is the wrong reason to go into chefing.
Oh, definitely,
right?
Yeah.
But you've mentioned discipline. So yes, we can all cook at home and yes, we can do beautiful food. But if you do not have discipline to be a chef, you shouldn't be in the game.
No, it's you're going to struggle.
It's a hardcore profession.
It is, yeah.
Through hot... you know, stinky days through to, you know, flooded roofs and, you know, and let's face it, everybody's out there having a party and you're the one cooking for them. So you don't go in it for the glamour.
And there's also the side of it that everyone just sees the chef as in the kitchen making my dinner, but there's another side to the business as well, yeah.
Exactly. And I mean, a lot of chefs are owners of restaurants too, so they have to take all that on board. Plus, if you're an executive chef, you've got to have your profit and loss, and you've got to, you know, there's a whole finance department behind an executive chef in their head.
Yeah.
So mental health of chefs has always worried me because I've worked with young chefs before that have really gone off the rails.
Mm.
Why do you think that is? Just because it's late nights and...
Yeah, it's
tough.
It's a combination of things. I think it's easy access to stuff, whether it's alcohol or drugs, or it's the
because of the
unsociable hours as well.
Right. So then you hang with other chefs.
Or yeah,
other
that's
people
right.
In the hospitality industry. Yeah.
You come home late at night. Your friends or family or kids or whatever may be sleeping, or and you've got nothing else
you've
to
wind
do.
Down.
Or, yeah. So you have a beer or a wine or you know that's.
And then some of the younger staff will go, we're going out on a Monday because it's our weekend. So then it's really difficult to have that sort of full-time family and then have the weekends of a chef, isn't it? And it is on the partner as well because they don't have you home at all on the
weekends. That's right.
There's all that is a trade-off. And that's why a lot of hospitality people marry hospitality people.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they open up a restaurant together. But then, you know, then there's the price of the child, and, you know, when do they, and they fall into the restaurant, you know. Having owned a restaurant, we had that, I had a glimpse of that.
Yeah.
And then put both my boys on the floor. But having said that, that's the best skills they've learnt in their lives thus far. Forget about school and all the rest.
You're learning a lot in hospitality.
That's right, yeah, from the ground up. And how to converse, particularly this generation, with people. Because if you're not into the general public, do not open a restaurant.
Yeah. And especially in working in kitchens too, you meet a wide variety of people, and you meet a lot of people that have a lot of problems as well. And there's a reason they're working in kitchens, because there's nothing else they could do. Or,
yeah.
They couldn't be employed because they've had a criminal past or...
Yeah, yeah. So there's... And it's
drug
not,
issues or whatever it is, yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily pay really well either, does
no,
it?
No,
I think
no.
you really... I was talking to a baker the other day. You're really undervalued in your profession.
I think so.
He was actually giving me a good insight into, because he had a plumber over. I was like, I mean, bloody plumbers, they charge a fortune, right?
Yeah.
And he had a plumber over, and, you know, before they even walk in the door, they said it's going to be, you know, $250 or something. And he thought about it, and he thought, hang on a second, I made a cake... for someone's 50th the other day. And this lady gave me grief because it was $50 and she wanted it delivered within 24 hours.
And it probably took them 4 hours to make.
So this plumber had said, no, can't make it today, can't make it then, I'll come whenever. Mm. And it's $250, right?
Yeah.
And he was thinking, imagine if I reversed that and said to her, well, your cake's not going to be ready for a week. I don't give a shit that your birthday's tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it's $250 up front. You know, and he was just saying how bakers are undervalued.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like $23 an hour or something. Still.
Chef and baker, especially, every good skilled chefs, it's a trade in its own right. Have Welding didn't pay well either, but...
Yeah, I know, and they're all hardcore jobs that we need.
They're very highly skilled
Absolutely.
Jobs.
Absolutely,
yeah.
You need them. Let's hope that through this COVID and all this, you know, working from home and just... you know, the rich man getting richer. Let's hope this sort of turns back towards some really, you know, fair income trades.
Yeah,
that's
what
we need. So at the casino, though, you would have been looked after in the sense of the apprenticeship, and they would have paid you the right, you know, that would have been a good foundation for you to start.
Yeah.
So did you finish your apprenticeship there?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
And then where did Mikey go from there?
I went from casino. I started off, I did my apprenticeship in about 2.5 to 3 years, and that... I started off, you know, in the bottom in the veggie shop, then you went to the butcher's, the fish shop.
Fantastic.
Into the production, the largest southern production kitchen in the southern hemisphere. You know, I was cooking lamb shanks off of cranes and stuff like massive, massive jobs. It scared me at first because I was like, what if I stuff it up?
Yeah,
like,
right.
There's like $50,000 worth of beef mince here. If I burn this bolognese, I'm in the shit.
That's a huge learning, though. Yeah.
You do all that before you even go into a restaurant.
Yeah.
You go into a pastry kitchen and you learn.
Wow, that's fantastic.
And you've been working with a massive variety of staff. So you learn a lot of skills, a lot of cuisines. You learn from even little old ladies making the sandwiches and stuff, the way that they do it and stuff. And you pick up bits from every area. And then you start doing cafe work, then the buffet, then you go to the fine dining restaurants. And then you sort of find what you like.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed the... At the time, I was in the Italian and the fine dining restaurants that were upstairs, and I liked that.
Yeah. Just
getting, you know, nicer produce and lobsters and truffles would come along, and I found that exciting.
It's the fine dining side comes
Yeah, out. And I wanted to learn how can I cook that fish the best, because maybe in the cafe downstairs we were pumping out, you know, $10 meals. It's
not the same.
Nah, it's not as
so
good quality product or whatever.
So where did you go after the casino, now that you learned all this?
I went to Peppers.
On the Gold Coast?
No, here down at Salt.
Oh, you came straight down here.
Yeah.
Okay, to Season.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Season for a moment, because this is actually one of our long-standing restaurants in Kingscliff, in the Salt Village, and part of was Mantra, which was now a core group.
Yeah.
And Season is a hatted restaurant. I think it still is a hatted restaurant. It was for many years. I'm not sure what's going on now. Hasn't been open for a while, has it?
Yeah, I think it's shut. Yeah.
Yeah. So when you worked there, you were working under an executive chef that had a hat, and you literally went straight into that team, and before you knew it, you became almost like the head chef. Is that right?
Well, I started off, I took the job at Peppers as a chef de partie in the banqueting and conferencing.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing the conferencing, the weddings, the big functions, all the buffets and the big cater. Because coming from the casino, you're doing functions for... 1,500, 2,000 people, like massive, massive job. So to come down here, it was quieter, nicer, closer to home.
Yeah.
My biggest function would maybe be 250 to 300 people. So for me, I found that a bit, well, this is nice. It's a bit less stressful.
Mm.
I can cope with this. I'd never taken a position.
And then you became a young dad around about the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was a bit nervous because I'd never taken a role that big.
Mm.
I was just a qualified chef, but I don't know. When I took the job, I was like, I can do this. Mm. I know I could do it.
But
it was
because of what you'd learnt, though. Yeah. At the casino. Yeah.
So I just went in and smashed it. And they had a really good chef in season at the time. Daniel Watts was there at the time.
I remember Dan.
Yeah, he'd done some out there food. He was a crazy fella. And then he left. And then I was still doing banquets.
That's when MasterChef was there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, they filmed it. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
So Dan was there. He'd left the boys a bit scarred, I think, with some of his crazy ideas in the prep.
So what did Mikey bring to the table?
Oh, he left, and then they went through, another chef had come into season, and then he left, and then another chef came in, and then the standard of the food started going down. And
so you said, I better take this
on. It was stressing our exec chef out a little bit, and Danelle, who was the assistant exec chef at the time, one of my good friends, we were having a beer outside of work, and I'd spoken to Ange about it, and I was like, do you think I should, you know, put my hand up and say, if you need someone in there, I'll give it a crack, because I felt I was ready. And I was starting to do some food conference-wise that was better than the food in the signature restaurant.
Yeah.
And it was breaking my heart a little bit, and the boys in there were a bit deflated, and it sort of created a bit, it rubbed off into my department that season was going down a bit. Yeah. So.
And it had to keep up a certain level because it had had that MasterChef filming, it had had the hat.
Yeah, that's right. It had a big, a good reputation.
I can see this fitting very well for you going into that position. And that's when we met you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd seen the differences in the kitchen, but when we met you, the thing that I noticed with your food was it was very artistic in the sense that the ingredients that you were putting together showed me that there was a chef that knew his produce.
Yeah.
But secondly, your desserts were next level. They were really good.
Just winging it.
Yeah, and you were doing hearty food too, which ticked the boxes of my husband, like, you know, the old wooden board with the big lamb on there with the potatoes. And so in a way, you kind of brought your Scottish heritage to it, didn't you?
Yeah, I still do that even. You know, up at Pottinger now.
So you left you left season. We went to Taverna, which is a Greek taverna in Kingsley, which is really gorgeous. And you would have kind of got into your seafood side again there, did you?
Yeah, I enjoyed that style because I've been to Greece and Santorini, and I love Mediterranean food. I'd done the Italian restaurant. I'd never done Greek cuisine type.
And you did style. Touch a little bit out at Mavis's for a short time out there to sort of, you wanted to get into that garden kitchen.
Yeah, that's right.
That was in your bones, wasn't it?
Yeah, the big draw for me there was the produce in the garden. There was a lot of stuff I'd never used.
I can see where the circle goes here from the casino to season to Taverna. It's funny doing these podcasts because people don't even realise themselves how the pieces of the puzzle all match up.
Yeah.
But they actually do, you know, and there's a full circle with
I'm
you
I'm doing
here.
A lap of the tweeds,
yeah. Yeah, well, there's a full circle with you here as well. I can see where it's sort of your introduction to seafood in Australia with your flatmates, you know, like it kind of does come back around. So you're at Taverna, you have a wonderful summer there and you do some beautiful food there. My husband and I were like, oh, Mikey's here now. We can tell the food is like next level. It's really cool. And then you move on and you get an opportunity to go up to Pottinger. So let's talk about Pottinger because that's been a really a beautiful place for you to land, but it's, you know, it's had some real challenges because of what they were going through.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what that looks like for you.
Oh, so Pottinger's been good, you know. It's a good friend of ours, my wife's best friend, her husband's worked there for the last 3 years or so. And he'd asked me before, you know, would I ever be interested in working there, but I was happy where I was working and et cetera.
Is this a sommelier?
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Sal. Do you know Sal?
Yeah, no, I've met Sal, the sommelier, yeah.
I've known Sal for pretty much since I've been in Australia, 10, 11 years.
Yeah, right.
And then he sort of brought it up again, like, you know, Gareth was sick and passed away. And
yeah, so the owners, just to put you in the picture here, the owners are a beautiful couple, Gareth and Pete, up there at Pottinger's, and they've created this dream restaurant, really what they wanted. It's
come
from their heart, and it's a garden kitchen.
Yeah.
Beautiful gardens, really kind of old house that they've renovated into this stunning but really understated place to eat. You don't feel like it's too sort of pompous. It's just really organic and it's just a natural, beautiful place to eat, really, and sit up on the deck there.
Yeah.
And Gareth, unfortunately, passed away late last year, the head chef and owner. So I guess for Pete, big shoes to fill.
Yeah, that's right. He had a good chef there, Ryan. Then I think Ryan was moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, I'm not sure if Pete was in two minds of, like, where do I go from here? Do I close the restaurant?
Give myself some
keep it
time.
Going. They're trying to hire another chef or,
And Self must have known that job was for you.
Yeah, and then it came up again and my wife was kind of like,
just do it.
Yeah, give it a go.
So it's a beautiful location. You drive up that hill. You don't live far from there as well. You drive up that hill. Talk to me about what you feel. You must have to love a restaurant to work at it. What happens when you drive through those gates? What do you feel?
Oh, it's good. It's awesome. It's a nice little drive up to Karoolie. I'd never been to Kirill till I went for the interview with Pete. I knew where it was, I just never went up the hill. But when I started driving up, beautiful. Yeah, it was.
And you saw the gardens.
I've seen wallabies and snakes and all sorts of stuff going up that road. And and then you'll get to the gate and you see the beautiful gardens. They look amazing at the moment, actually, because...
And you get to realise all that produce.
That's it. Yeah. And I walk past, sometimes every day there, I still find stuff I've never seen before. I walk past in the way and, you know, there's some native berry there or something.
I feel like we had a lunch up there not that long ago before the COVID scenario, because we'll probably end with, you know, how you've turned that restaurant around, really. So you just kind of get your feet in the door and... You get cracking on the menu, and we had a beautiful lunch up there. And, you know, give me some of the dishes that you were creating up there before the COVID, something that I would have loved up there.
I was trying to use as much, you know, local good produce stuff again. We were using, you know, Jonas from Fair Game Wild Venison.
The venison, the Australian Bay Lobster. Yeah.
Luca down at Byron Bay Mozzarella.
Beautiful.
Australian Bay Lobster. Yeah. I was just shrimp mushrooms, but they've closed for a bit.
You just reminded me. I had this, I think it was burrata or maybe mozzarella. Tell me what you would do with burrata or mozzarella. They're one of my favourites. And the boys down at Byron Bay, are, you know, straight from Bloody Amalfi, and they know what they're doing. What would you put with it to make it a really flash salad?
I think mozzarella and burrata and stuff, they don't actually have much flavour to them.
You did something to mine that I remember. And I'm just
it was basil oil and pickled tomatoes.
Basil oil, pickled tomatoes.
And some rosemary focaccia, I think.
Right, beautiful. Yeah, so something simple like that, the basil oil and the
an idea is, you know, tomatoes. You cut that burrata and you get a bit on your toast, you take the tomato, you've got the basil, you just mix it all up and eat.
It's beautiful. There's always colourful edible flowers as well.
Yeah, there's a lot in the garden.
So do you make your own breads and things up there?
We make everything from scratch, pretty much. Ice creams, breads,
incredible. Well, you've got that pastry. Opportunity up there, haven't you? You've got the time and you've got the opportunity. Mm. So then the doors had to close for this isolation thing. And then you guys had to get really creative as a team. And you and Pete sat down and said, what can we do? How do we keep this going? So you came up with a takeaway menu.
Yeah, we sat in takeaway. Not sure how it would go, you know, in Kirill.
You're sort of in the middle of nowhere, really.
Yeah, but it was very popular. You know, the locals up there have supported us and gave us good business every single week. Like, I was getting orders for takeaway for $300 worth of takeaway just from a family of three or four.
How gorgeous is that?
Every week.
People down in Tweed were driving up the hill as well?
Yeah, we got a few. Yeah, people even from Murwillumbah. We had people that had never even been to the restaurant before ordering and stuff.
Love it. And you weren't doing delivery. You were literally...
Pick up only.
Yeah. And as you and I discuss, it's really hard to kind of put a... It's not a fine dining restaurant, it's just a bloody good restaurant into a takeaway container.
That's right,
But
we were still trying to do it, you know, I was trying to set a good standard there. So I was like, don't want to drop that for takeaway.
And you really well, yeah. too. Yeah. So just before we end this podcast about who and where inspires you, I phoned you up and said, look, you know, it's my husband's 50th in isolation. You're going to have to do something for me, Mikey. And I'd look at you as either really banging lamb, which I already had sorted with Chef Pepe, or really good desserts. You said, no worries, I'll bring down the Maya
lemon meringue, yeah.
Yeah, and they were just insane. you're like, they're nothing. Just bought them in the house, and that's what we had for the birthday celebration. So you do have a love of desserts, don't you?
Yeah, I enjoyed the pastry side of the apprenticeship, but then I sort of fell out of love with it, but, you know, it was a bit... I don't know. You've got to weigh everything. It's messy. And I like to cook from the heart and just by touch and feel. So I don't like standing there weighing and robot style. I just like
to... So it's the hearty Scottish food that you bring back through. Yeah. Yeah, that warm. But that's part of your character. You're a warm, hearty guy. And I really feel like you put that into your food.
Yeah.
So... It's funny with the dessert, though, because I just had a flashback of you baking that chocolate cake on a Saturday night, you know? So you've probably done a lot of desserts and you've followed that path. But I think you're in a new level of your career now, you know? You're really going to deliver a kitchen garden to people's homes.
Yeah.
And you've got that opportunity up there.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, we're replanting the whole garden at the moment.
Are you doing some of that as well?
I give the boys up there have a massive list of... stuff I want in the garden.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. So you get to choose what you plan.
Pretty much, which is all going to obviously be seasonal stuff, so I'm trying to plan ahead for spring.
So what does it look like? You guys would probably be all right in July, June when you got the 50 people restaurant. Is it 20 or 50 in June?
I think up to 50 packs, but I think it's every four square meters.
Four square meters, right. So how many would you be able to fit in a four square meter each?
I think at the moment... Like see, between 10 and 15, I think.
Yeah, right.
But we can do two sittings, so we can sort of take 30 for lunch.
Yeah.
And then probably 30 for dinner.
And you'll keep your takeaway going, probably, I'd imagine.
We're not sure yet.
Yeah, right, just see how
it's just week by week. See, well, last week, we didn't get much takeaway.
Yeah, a lot of people are dropping off on that. But yeah. I think that's the thing with hospitality and tourism at the moment. Nobody knows, and every day that's changing. It.
Yeah.
But the thing that I do know is you guys have been all really resilient and connected as chefs as well. Like, everyone's been talking to everybody and helping the industry out. I think that's the way that's going to go forward. So I'm excited to come back up to Pottinger. In fact, it might be one of my first places I go out.
Oh, yeah.
Look out. Now, I want to finish with who... Thank you for this story. You've got a great story,
Mikey. Oh, thank you.
And I love the way you've kind of gone from welding under the bridge to...
Cooking under the
2,500 people, shanks from cranes, and the casino. So who and where, two, a people and a place, inspires you?
Who inspires me? At the moment, probably my wife inspires me.
That's a great answer.
Yeah, it's the right answer.
I think it's a good answer. A good answer. And why is that?
We have three beautiful children, and she has to put up with a... You know, temperamental Scottish chef husband.
And you have twins. You have twins.
Twins and a 4-year-old twins and a 2-year-old boy. So, yeah, she's a big inspiration to me. All of them are, you know.
Oh, your family. Yeah. Just beautiful. Yeah. I love that, Mikey. That's a good Scottish answer there.
And a place.
Yeah, a place.
Yeah, Australia or Scotland, probably. Because both of them, I'm kind of torn between the two.
I'm
still Scottish, but I love it here too. I love to go home, but I love to come back.
Do you see any similarities between the two countries?
Yeah.
Yeah, and what are they?
I think the Australian people, like, very similar to Scottish terms, like very warm. Yeah. Like the banter.
Yeah.
Like to have a good time, take the piss a little bit. Yeah.
Have a joke.
Yeah, there's a good warmth to Australian people. Yeah, and Scottish people, very similar, I think, yeah.
Well, you know... A lot of Australians are Scottish.
Yeah.
So that works well. Hey, really great to catch up with you today. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
And we've actually, I'm able to do them face to face again, which is really nice.
Yeah.
And we'll come up to the restaurant soon. I can't wait to see, let's hope your feet are grounded at Pottinger's for a while now, because I want to see what you're going to be doing on that menu. It's going to be really cool.
Yeah, we sort of started a new menu 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, right.
And I kept it the same last year. He's been getting a lot of good feedback.
Give me one of the winner dishes on that menu.
The barbecue chicken's been selling very well.
What have you put with the barbecue chicken?
So I make a sort of garden veg succotash, and I make a sort of barbecue rum glaze. So it's a chicken supreme.
Rum, did you say?
Yeah, I'm using the...
Are you using the husk rum?
Yeah.
Ah, you've just won me over then. So you're using the husk rum from the distillery out at Timbolgum in the barbecue chicken.
And I glaze the chicken with that, and we've got a sort of garden veg succotash and a red pepper sauce and bacon and crumbs.
When are you opening again?
No, we're open now. Oh, we're open again back for lunch on Friday.
No, I mean as in right now. Can I drive up there now to get it?
No, we're closed until Friday.
Okay, gotcha. Nice to see you, my friend. We'll be up at the restaurant very soon.
Thank you, Kaylee.
Ciao, ciao.
Bye.